From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today, Damian Lewis, the classically trained British actor who's played a lot of Americans, a ruthless hedge fund manager in the Showtime series Billions, an American war hero in the HBO miniseries Band of Brothers, and in the series Homeland, a Marine sergeant who converts to Islam in captivity. After attending a state dinner at the White House, he gave President Obama a DVD box set with a special note.
And so I wrote, ironically, from one Muslim to another, and your great fan, Damian Lewis. Then had a panic a few weeks later that I, God, just hope he has a sense of irony and knows that this is a joke.
Also, critic Soraya Nadia McDonald reviews the new Netflix miniseries When They See Us about the Central Park 5 case. That's coming up on today's Fresh Air. Our guest today, actor Damian Lewis, has become something of a staple of hit American cable TV series. He played a World War II hero in the HBO series Band of Brothers. In the Showtime series Homeland, he was an American Marine sergeant who returns from captivity in Syria with ties to terrorists, a role that earned him Golden Globe and Primetime Emmy Awards. And in the Showtime series Billions, he plays the ruthless hedge fund manager Bobby Axelrod, who's pursued by an ethically challenged federal prosecutor played by Paul Giamatti. By the time the fourth season ended last night, twists of plot had radically altered the relationship between the two, turning them into strategic allies. The show has been renewed for a fifth season. Despite his convincing portrayal of Americans of blue-collar origin, Lewis is a classically trained British actor who attended Eton, the historic boarding school known for educating British aristocrats and royals. I spoke to Damian Lewis last week. Well, Damian Lewis, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good morning. Hi.
Let's talk about Billions, the series on Showtime which you're starring in. And I thought we'd begin by hearing a clip. This is from season four, the current season. You play Bobby Axelrod, this tough-as-nails hedge fund manager. You came up from the streets and made it in the financial world. And you're on an airport tarmac where a Russian oligarch who's played by John Malkovich, who's been an adversary of yours, is getting on his private jet because he's been ordered out of the country by the state attorney general. And as it happens, you, Bobby Axelrod, actually engineered this. And you've come to the tarmac to have a final word with him as he's dealing with this defeat and humiliation. And as it opens, we hear you tell your adversary that you have a parting gift for him.
The few billion that you have at Tater Mason Capital will be unfrozen and released back to you once you land back home.
That's something. But it is actually my money you're giving back to me. I'm not sure how much gratitude that buys.
Do you want it or not?
Yeah, sure. Will I get it?
You will. The moment you land, as I said.
Good.
Gregor, listen. Here's the thing. After the cash hits your account, you may start feeling that you didn't get your satisfaction, that you have some further score you want to settle with me. You're going to want to tamp down that feeling. Sure, it's true. I didn't have you do my killing for me. But don't let that trick you into thinking that I don't have the will or the ability to do it under different circumstances. Like when I'm threatened. You send someone after me here, they're going to find that I'm a very insulated, protected, and powerful man in these parts, and there is nothing that I won't do to defend what's mine.
That is our guest Damian Lewis on the series Billions, speaking there with John Malkovich. What appealed to you about this role?
When I came over to talk to the guys about whether we'd move forward with this, and by the guys I mean Brian Koppelman and David Levine, I wanted to know what their worldview was, because it seemed clear to me that that is the direction the show would go in. And what we have at the outset is we have a mythic context of a sheriff and a cowboy, a sheriff and a gunslinger. The sheriff is played in this case by Paul Giamatti, the U.S. attorney, and I play the gunslinger, who is a hedge fund manager here in New York. And what the guys wanted to explore was the way in which the politically and financially powerful here live and operate and the different moral code by which they seem to live by. And what became clear was that this was going to be a world, and what has become clear over the last 3 or 4 years is a world that absolute power corrupts absolutely. And even the good guys do bad things. The bad guys will occasionally do good things. Loyalty is paramount. So it's a world of ego and power. And Bobby Axelrod was set up as a guy who was in some ways the embodiment of the American dream, a blue-collar alley cat, a scrapper with a mid-ranging university education. They make a big deal of the fact that he was at Hofstra. He is not an Ivy League guy. And he has become a billionaire.
I read that Andrew Ross Sorkin, the New York Times financial writer, who was also, a co-producer, co-creator, introduced you to some hedge fund executives. What did you want to learn from them, from those meetings?
It would be too simplistic just to lump them all into one group. They were all very different characters, some with an explicit vanity in, you know, the cost of their haircut, to the suits they wore, to the winter jackets they had, and the offices with priceless works of art on the walls. But I found with every single one of them, probably the one thing I could say is they were all incredibly focused listeners. And we're all keen to impress on me that this was not a Wall Street environment anymore. This was not a Gordon Gekko environment anymore. It wasn't dog eat dog. It was much more a risk intolerant, analytical, scientific world where risk was removed from the equation before a bet is made, before an investment is made.
It's not that they're ripping people's throats out. It's that they're smarter and more analytical than everybody else.
Before they rip someone's throat out.
Right. Any mannerisms or personality traits that you kind of integrated into Bobby Axelrod's character?
Brian and David had written something of a rock star, a guy with swagger and confidence. I wanted to give him a sense of the street, so nothing too refined. He is a guy who's committed to wearing, you know, $1,000 sneakers and jeans and cashmere hoodies. That's his thing, rather than an expensive Italian suit. I wanted to find a prowl in him, something predatory in him. And ever since I was trained as an actor, I've always enjoyed using animals, finding that sort of anthropomorphic quality between human beings and animals. And I sort of found a cheetah quality in him that I have used, you know, from the get-go.
Right. When you were filming the first season, it was probably during the 2016 election. And I'm wondering how, you know, Trump and the Trump administration have influenced your thinking or the plot lines as this has developed.
Well, it was fascinating having a president in the White House who tore up the political and diplomatic rule book and said, no, what's king here is the transaction, is the deal, and I will go and I will make deals for America. Bobby Axelrod is entirely a transactional human being. This is not unlike the current president. So it's been a happy thing for us that he's been there, weirdly, because it does make our show even more, I think, contemporary, more current, even more explicitly a commentary on contemporary America. That might seem pessimistic because the show has quite a bleak world view, but these things go on. So
you know, I'm wondering what it's like to act in these scenes with Paul Giamatti, where you're really going mano a mano and you really are guys with two very different kinds of power. He's the law enforcement guy, you're the economic power, and kind of how that played out.
Paul's become a pal. He's an absolute delight to work with. He's a powerhouse of an actor, and I love how present he is in every scene. Initially, They were so climactic, the scenes when Axe and Chuck would come together, that I think we had to resist. We had to kind of just calm ourselves down. We did, I think, a couple of takes, which were big, really big. I'm gonna out-act you. And then we would calm down and just let the story take care of itself. But, you know, in mythic terms, he's the sheriff, I'm the gunslinger. You know, but they're as equally corrupt as each other. And, you know, it's a story about shysters being shysters, and there are no two bigger shysters than Chuck Rhodes and Bobby Axelrod.
My guest Damian Lewis stars in the Showtime series Billions. Here's a scene featuring one of those confrontations he was talking about between Bobby Axelrod, the hedge fund manager played by Lewis, and Paul Giamatti as Chuck Rhodes, the federal prosecutor who's gunning for him. Rhodes is bitter about what's happening in his marriage. His wife, who works for Axelrod, has left him.
My wife kicked me out.
Good for her. But she's not here either, if you're trying to find her. We've both lost her.
Oh. Well, then maybe you have a sliver of my pain. As you've stripped away everything that matters to me.
You came at me!
Because you're a criminal, Bob. And it's my job to shut him down and put him in jail.
Well, if that's true, you're not very good at it.
You didn't grow up in a background like Bobby Axelrod, but you didn't come from humble origins. Tell us a little bit about your family and your schooling.
No, I'm a privately educated Brit. I couldn't have come from a further away world than Bobby, I guess. I grew up on Abbey Road, actually. Any fan of the Beatles will know where that is, in North London. I went to boarding schools from an early age, from the age of 8, and came out of school at the age of 18, and knew by that stage I wanted to be an actor, and went about trying to do that, and auditioned like everybody does for drama schools. I was at somewhere called the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, which was a music conservatory as well as a drama school. And I continued from there. I had very supportive parents. My father was in the city. He was, a city gent in London, but an actor manqué in many ways. Loved the theatre. Is really responsible for my love of the theatre. Took us all to the theatre a lot when we were kids. Often big West End musicals. He had lived himself in Chicago for 5 years in the 60s. So loved and felt a great affiliation with all those old school American 1930s, 40s musicals, 42nd Street, On Your Toes, Guys and Dolls. And whenever there was a revival, we would go. Mm. I always acted at school. I went to schools where theater programs were very active. You were really encouraged to get involved.
Did it ever occur to you that you had a particularly interesting face?
There was a very brutal exercise that we were asked to do at drama school. We spent one semester, one of our classes was on makeup. And they give you a piece of paper with a blank oval shape on it, which is your head. And you had to stare at yourself in the mirror for an entire semester and draw on this blank oval your face with all its imperfections. So you knew every imperfection on your face. And there is nothing that is straight or symmetrical or matching on my face. I can tell you that. So it's kind of a depressing exercise when you do it, but it's also incredibly useful when you're making yourself up in the theater. But no, I never thought I had an interesting face. In fact, the opposite. I probably worried that I didn't have the right kind of face.
The point of the exercise was to be aware of what you could do with your face on stage?
Really, it was a makeup exercise. If you've got a bent nose and you want it straightened, you know how to shade and highlight in order to do that. If you want to exaggerate an imperfection, like one of your ears is higher than the other or one eye is smaller than the other, all of which is true of me. If your mouth doesn't sit directly under your nose, which is also true of me,
You know, and you might be playing a character. You might think that's useful. So let's exaggerate that. Let's use makeup to stick your mouth even further out of the way from under your nose, or exaggerate your broken nose, which I have from playing cricket when I was 11 years old. That kind of stuff.
You did a lot of theater and did it well and got into television. I guess, you know, in 2001, you appeared in Band of Brothers, which was this great HBO series about a battalion in World War II. You've ended up playing a lot of Americans, particularly, you know, Americans of blue-collar backgrounds. And people have talked a lot about the authenticity of your accent. How did you get that?
It's been a big sort of 20-year-long mistake, this, that I've been playing Americans. And you're right to pinpoint Band of Brothers. Something happened in the casting of Band of Brothers, I think, which caused such a frenzy amongst all the young acting community in LA when it was announced that Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks were going to make this show with HBO. When they came to London, and they were always going to use some British actors, I'm afraid it was for no more romantic reason than for tax breaks, because they were going to film it almost entirely. We filmed it almost entirely in a studio north of London and in the countryside around.
Again, transactions govern everything.
Transaction. I'm afraid so. So there were British actors peppered throughout Easy Company. I don't think they ever expected to find the hero of the piece in London, but the way they explained it to me was that these guys were 1930s men, born in the first half of the 20th century. And there was something, as explained to me, there was something in me, something in my bearing, something in, I don't know, an upright way in which I walked, maybe to do with my theater training or something, that gave me an old-fashioned air that they said wasn't necessarily typical of a cool, hip, you know, Hollywood actor of the of the 21st century. And that's what they seem to identify. So totally by accident, and obviously my American accent was good enough, and they cast me in it. And it was the happiest accident of my life. It was a great, great honor to play Dick Winters. And because he was an American icon, people didn't know about him then, but they've come to know him.
He's a real character.
And he is a true American hero, or just a hero, but it just meant people identified entirely with me as an American actor, an American hero, and I have been offered American roles ever since.
Yeah.
I'm just very, very lucky. And, you know, the Hollywood machine whirred into action around me, and flights were booked right in front of me, and cars were booked, and hotels were booked, and, you know, two or three days later, I was gone. I was in L.A. sitting in front of Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks, and I was a young 28-year-old British actor who had just done 2 years at the Royal Shakespeare Company and at the Donmar Warehouse, and played Hamlet in Regent's Park in our open-air theater, which is our Delacorte Theater in London. And so I was that guy. I was a British theater actor.
So how did it go with Hanks and Spielberg?
It was incredible. I got there and Hanks was there. He was in the middle of filming Castaway, and he was in the middle of the break of filming Castaway, so they could give him the 6 months he needed, or 9 months, to grow this beard. So by the time I got to him, I think I got to him in about month seven. So he was already just like a couple of eyeballs behind a lot of hair, you know, which was just, and he was just sitting in the room. Ron Livingston was there, who played Lewis Nixon so beautifully, who was Dick Winters' best friend. And Tom sat there, obviously having the time of his life, playing all the other characters while Ron and I did our pieces. And I went back to my very swanky hotel, Shutters on the Beach in Santa Monica, just thinking, oh my God, this is it. This is Hollywood. This is LA. This is what happens. This is so exciting. And I went out. I have to say to you right now, I went out. I got absolutely trashed, slightly jet lagged, very excited to be there, and got pretty drunk, came home about 4 a.m. to get a phone call, totally unexpectedly, at 8:00 a.m. from the gorgeous Meg Lieberman, who was casting it, and said, Damien, Stephen wants to see you this morning. And I woke up with 4 hours sleep, sweaty and shaking, and, you know, whiskey sort of oozing out of every pore. I had 3 showers, 9 cups of coffee, and ran in shaking to just have a chat with Stephen and Tom again. And Stephen videoed the whole thing, and we just had a great chat before he said, okay, I got to go watch my kid play soccer. And he went.
And you
and that was it. And I was left. And just after he went, Tom and Tony Toe turned to me and said, so boot camp starts in April. Congratulations.
Wow.
And, you know, that was as big a moment as I've had.
Damian Lewis stars in the Showtime series Billions. After a break, he'll talk about playing opposite Claire Danes in the series Homeland and about what it takes to get an American accent right. Also, Soraya Nadia McDonald reviews the new Netflix series When They See Us about the Central Park 5 case. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Capital One. Capital One wants to build a better bank, one that feels and acts nothing like a typical bank. So they're reimagining banking. They offer a great savings rate and accounts with no fees or minimums that can be opened from anywhere in 5 minutes. That's banking reimagined. Capital One. What's in your wallet? Capital One N.A.
Let's get back to my interview with British actor Damian Lewis. I want to talk about Homeland, which was a big deal, the Showtime series that you were in for 3 seasons. Your character is this Marine who served overseas, was captured and held and tortured for years. And it's a wild plot. You end up becoming involved with American politics and intelligence. We learn that your character actually is a Muslim, is involved with terrorist groups. There's a lot going on with this character. How did you prepare for this role?
I sort of looked at 3 separate strands of it, what it was like to be a Marine. And I had some experience of soldiering through Band of Brothers, but I did a little bit of updating. I didn't go into a SEER training or anything crazy like that, but I researched being a Marine. I spoke to a couple Marines. I also looked at PTSD, and I went to a unit, a facility in England, and spoke to them about the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And I read the Quran, and I went to the Central London Mosque in London, which is not far from where I live, and they welcomed me in there. And in fact, when I was in North Carolina, I also spent some time in the mosque. It's a very small mosque there, run by a nice cleric there, a mullah there, who I think was from Lebanon, actually. And there are about 10,000 Muslims in Charlotte, North Carolina. And so I spent a bit of time there just absorbing the culture and read the Quran. And that was it, really. That's how I prepared for it.
Yeah, it's interesting because the series, you know, I think was at times drew criticism for demonizing Muslims and at other times being too kind to Al-Qaeda. Did any of that criticism, I don't know, affect what you did on the set? Or did it, I guess a lot of it came long after you'd finished the episodes, right?
Well, certainly in the first 3 seasons when I was there, I was approached often by Muslims in the street who would thank me for a sensitive portrayal of being Muslim, of worshipping in the faith. And I think that's because whenever Nicholas Brody, although there were clear associations between having adopted the Muslim faith and wanting to blow people up, whenever he was alone and praying, I think people felt there was a sensitivity and an authenticity to that, and they thanked me for that. And the thing that we're trying to establish in Homeland was that it wasn't that he had been radicalized by Abu Nazir. It was that he was a deeply disturbed, vulnerable man after 7 years of solitary confinement, who turned to this faith through Abu Nazir as a sort of mentor father figure. But it was actually it was actually the sort of personal cost of the school that he worked in and the loss of life to children because of drones from the US. And that was kind of the politically radical thing about the show, was that was there a sort of state terrorism being enacted by the US through the use of drones? And he felt motivated for personal reasons to come back and do something about it rather than being a radicalized suicide bomber. Right. That was a nuance that was, I think, was hard to convey, but that's what we were trying.
Right. It came out of his personal sense of outrage at that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's hear a clip. We're going to hear the CIA agent who's at the heart of the story, played by Claire Danes. And this is in the first season when you've come back and are recognized as a hero for having, you know, been liberated after 8 years of captivity in Iraq. But she's convinced that your character, this Marine Nicholas Brody, was turned into a terrorist operative by serving by this commander Abu Nazir while you were in captivity. And as things develop, the two of you meet, even though she's surveilling you, you develop a romantic relationship. And this scene is at a cottage where you go together in the woods, and you sense her suspicion about you and ask her about it, and she responds, yes. Let's listen.
Abu Nazir's bomb maker told me an American prisoner of war had been turned. He was coming home to carry out an attack.
And you believed this?
He told me minutes before he was executed.
So?
So he was my prisoner. I interrogated him for months. He was cooperating at the end. There was no reason for him to lie.
And you think I'm that POW?
There's no one else who could be.
You're telling me the CIA thinks I'm working for Al-Qaeda?
I think you're working for Al-Qaeda.
And that is Claire Danes and our guest actor Damian Lewis from the Showtime series Homeland. You know, what's interesting about this is, you know, you always think of actors as having to understand, you know, their character and their motivations. And what's interesting about this is in the first season, we don't know for the longest time what's in your head, right? I mean, even as clues are revealed, we're not sure whether you're a military hero, you're a dedicated to your country, or a secret Al-Qaeda operative, or a double agent. And I'm wondering what kind of challenge that is as an actor to present this enigma.
Well, first of all, you need good writing, which we had. It was beautifully wrought, the first season. I enjoy playing ambiguity. And this was a fabulous opportunity to do that. I think there's something, you know, clearly solipsistic about acting. Actors create their own realities for themselves. You enter a different world, a parallel reality, which is the world of the story. And the first thing an actor must always do is empathize, advocate for one's character. If the story is an argument, you represent one part of the argument and you play it with total conviction. So there may even have been moments through the first season where I believed Brody was a good man, because I think I'd done so much research into the PTSD and the sense of wrong, the sense of injustice about what had happened to him, and I think that's what sort of made him compelling and likable. People weren't sure, is this guy a good guy, or is he here to do something catastrophic? And of course, he doesn't actually fully know what he's going to be asked to do, and that doesn't happen until much later in the season, when he gets his instructions from Abu Nazir and he goes and meets the tailor, who is the maker of the vest,
the suicide vest. Yeah, vest.
Yeah, the suicide vest. So, you know, the ambiguity remains for those reasons, and she's not wrong, and Carrie's not wrong, but neither is Brody wrong, if you see what I mean.
Mm, yeah. Well, you know, the relationship between your character and Claire Danes takes some pretty wild swings. I mean, you're sleeping together. She's trying to put you in prison. She's mentally unstable. You're suffering from PTSD. What was the off-screen relationship like?
Similar. Very similar. Claire's a fabulous, lovely person, and smart and talented, and, you know, she's the backbone of the show.
Our guest is actor Damian Lewis, star of the Showtime series Homeland and the Showtime series Billions, which has been renewed for a fifth season. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor E-Trade. Investing your money shouldn't require moving mountains, no matter how much or how little experience you have. E-Trade makes investing simple. Along with great value, they provide the tools and support you need to navigate the markets, all to help your money work hard for you. For more information, visit etrade.com/NPR. E-Trade Securities, LLC. Member SIPC.
Blackface in a student yearbook. Blackfishing on Instagram. You got Israel and anti-Semitism. You got Israel and colonialism. You have go-go music versus the gentrifiers. On Code Switch, we take the subtext of race and make it text. So come chop it up with us.
This is Fresh Air, and we're speaking with actor Damian Lewis. You'll remember him from the Showtime series Homeland. He's now starring in the series Billions, which has been renewed for a fifth season. One more thing about Homeland. I read that President Obama, I think he was doing a state dinner for David Cameron, and he invited you and your wife, actress Helen McCrory, to attend, and you sat at the table with him. Is this true?
This is true. We were fully expecting to walk into the this marquee for 400 people on the South Lawn at the White House and to be sat next to the restrooms. And we were shown to this table, which seemed to be very close to the stage, where a band was going to perform later. And then the president walked in with our prime minister and walked straight to our table and sat opposite us. And we were amazed. And I had Warren Buffett on my left. I had an Afghanistan vet on my right who had won the Medal of Honor for an act of extreme bravery that I would wish we had long enough for me to go into and talk to you about now. But he had a bionic arm.
And you gave the president a gift, as I've read, right?
Well, yes. this was one of my more irreverent moments. I'm slightly blushing to remember that I did it. But the Teamsters for the Democrats came to visit us down in Charlotte and said, we've got a box set for the president. Would you like to sign a message to him? And I'm a huge fan, always was, of President Obama, and was, of course, very aware of all the accusations. One of them, some of them made by our current president, about his birthright, his nationality. And so I wrote, ironically, from one Muslim to another, and your great fan, Damian Lewis, and sent this off to the White House, and then had a panic a few weeks later that I God just hope he has a sense of irony and knows that this is a joke and why the joke's been made. And so, and I'd become friends with Jay, who was his who was the press officer at the White House at the time, and I sent an email and said, Jay, please tell me that my joke was understood. And he sent me an email back the next day reassuring me, said the president thought it was very funny and says thank you. And so I felt relieved, but there was a moment when I felt my cheekiness had, had maybe crossed the line, but I got away with it.
I wanted to talk a bit about a movie that you starred in called Keane, K-E-A-N-E, who's the name of your character. And I thought we'd play a bit from the beginning of this film. Do you want to just say a little bit about the character before we hear it?
This was a story based on an experience that Lodge Kerrigan, my dear friend, writer and director of the film, had when he lost for about 5 minutes his young girl, daughter, in a pharmacy. I think they were in a pharmacy. And everything flashed before him in 5 minutes, and thankfully he found her. So this film was an expression of that. What would it be like if he hadn't found her? And if you then met up with this character, the father, 6 months later or a year later, what sort of condition mentally would they be in? And so we have a film here, which is an exploration of grief and mental health. And
good.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, so this is really the very beginning of the film. It's at the Port Authority bus terminal in New York, and your character, Keane, walks up to the ticket window and asks to speak to one particular ticket agent to ask him something else. He's also holding a newspaper clipping about an abducted girl, which he shows them as the scene develops. Let's listen.
Excuse me, do you remember me?
Can I help you?
I bought some tickets from you last September. On the 12th? Clifton? I was with my daughter. She was abducted downstairs on the lower level. She was 6 at the time. She has red hair, and she came up to about here. She's wearing jeans and a purple jacket, and she has a dark blue backpack, and the jacket has a hood.
I haven't seen her.
I'm sorry. We sell hundreds of tickets a day.
Yeah, just thought she might have shown up. Someone might have seen her.
I'm sorry.
And that's our guest actor, Damian Lewis, starring in the film Keen. It's a powerful film, and you know, one thing I'm just noticing as I listen to that is how your voice is a register higher than it is here. Was that a conscious choice?
He was a man under duress, so... Yes, and clearly a man who's asking if they've seen his daughter who was abducted from, you know, Port Authority 6 months earlier is someone who is clearly unraveling. It's an irrational question. So yes, it was partly a choice. Although I will say something about performing in an American accent that phonetically it places my tongue in a different place in my mouth. The technicality of speaking in different dialects, and it sometimes does force my register up a little higher because my tongue closes at the back of my throat a little bit. And even when I'm playing Bobby Axelrod, I notice that sometimes I'm a little bit high, and it's weird. So I try to do vocal warm-ups, and especially as I'm flying backwards and forwards a lot from London, and you know, the voice is dried out from jet lag and airplanes and things like that. So I like to get it lower if I can.
You know, there are so many British actors that do terrific American accents. Like I think of Dominic West, who was in The Wire, who I think you were a schoolmate of, right?
Dom's a very good pal.
And I wonder, when Americans try to do British accents, do the British actors kind of laugh at them behind their backs?
I want to debunk this myth. Look, part of America's imperialism of the last century has been cultural imperialism, and we all grew up watching endless American shows. I grew up watching, reruns because I was too young originally, but, you know, Batman, and then all those amazing TV shows from the early 80s, Chips and Dukes of Hazzard and Hunter, works for me. And, you know, all those shows. And a lot of us English actors do manage to come up with a pretty good American accent. But I've heard some English actors that don't. And I've heard some American actors do incredibly convincing English accents, too.
Fair enough. Okay.
I suppose it sticks out. It sticks out when someone misses. But I think... We probably have a slight advantage because, you know, we're not France. We've welcomed American culture. We're the bridge between Europe and America. That's our special relationship. And we've grown up with a lot of American culture.
Well, it's been fun. Damian Lewis, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Damian Lewis stars in the Showtime series Billions. It concluded its fourth season last night and has been renewed for a fifth season. Coming up, Soraya Nadia McDonald reviews the new Netflix series When They See Us about the Central Park 5 case. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor E-Trade. Investing your money shouldn't require moving mountains, no matter how much or how little experience you have. E-Trade makes investing simple. Along with great value, they provide the tools and support you need to navigate the markets, all to help your money work hard for you. For more information, visit etrade.com/NPR. E-Trade Securities, LLC. Member SIPC.
We're back with a new season of Rough Translation.
Yeah.
And this time, we are following people who break the rules.
I mean, lying is part of the business.
In my opinion, the best revenge against ISIS is to be humane.
Am I supposed to punch
Yeah.
New episodes every other Wednesday. Subscribe.
The new Netflix miniseries directed by Ava DuVernay, When They See Us, is about the five New York teenagers who were wrongly convicted for the violent rape of a woman in Central Park in 1989. Critic Soraya Nadia McDonald has a review.
Their names are Raymond Santana, Corey Wise, Antron McRae, Yusuf Salam, and Kevin Richardson. They were known as the Central Park Five, accused of brutally assaulting and raping a white jogger. Their guilt, not their innocence, was presumed because they were Black and Latino. Police were determined to solve the rape case quickly, egged on by the press at a time when New York felt lawless. Cops rounded up all the kids they could and zeroed in on the five boys, aged 14 to 16, even though there was no evidence or logical timeline to tie them to the assault. The teens were held for hours without lawyers. Investigators vilified them in the news media. Donald Trump took out paid ads in New York papers calling for the state to bring back the death penalty and execute them. Now, a miniseries from writer and director Ava DuVernay provides a 360-degree view of how the case rocked each boy's family and how corrupt racist systems can doom innocent minorities. In 2012, Ken and Sarah Burns released their documentary, The Central Park Five. When They See Us hews closely to the facts that were presented in the documentary, but with some expected dramatic license, namely that it compresses the events in the first episode, but still represents the truth of the outcomes. Mostly, though, it fills in the lost years of the boys' lives. The story is a difficult one to watch, given that it features children begging for their parents and being treated like hardened career criminals. New York City prosecutor Linda Fairstein, who voiced objections to her portrayal after receiving much public criticism since the series premiered, is shown to have pursued the case aggressively, painting the five as monsters. In the series, she presses the case even though she recognizes there are problems with the timeline, which showed the boys were in different sections of the park at the time the jogger was raped. In this scene, Fairstein, played by Felicity Huffman, discusses the case with a detective played by William Sadler.
Trisha Miley lives East 83rd Street. My boyfriend says he spoke to her on the phone at 9 p.m. His assistant in the office placed the call for them. They talk, and she leaves to go out jogging. She's downstairs at 9:05. She says hi to the doorman and takes off on her regular run north on East Drive. Boyfriend says she's an experienced runner. She does a steady 8-minute mile. She goes in at 88th Street, 8 minutes per mile. It's 9:15 when she gets to the place where she's dragged off the road.
That's a 45-minute discrepancy.
We could pull the rape up to 9:20. You know, maybe she stopped to tie her shoes or something.
No, it's still out of whack. How can these same kids be raping her at the same time they're jumping bicyclists way over there?
Nothing on the weapon, question marks on the timeline. I mean, we got problems.
DuVernay is experienced in uncovering the beauty in difficult stories, especially those about how everyday Black lives are disrupted by systemic injustice. Throughout previous works, Middle of Nowhere, Queen Sugar, and Selma, two things remain consistent. She focuses on relationships, and she maintains a moral clarity about who has power in our society, who does not, and how that power is abused. DuVernay balances the stories of five separate families and the challenges of having a child in prison, thanks to gutting performances from the ensemble cast. One of the stories, that of Antron McRae's incarceration, is one of bitterness and guilt. Antron is bitter because his father Bobby didn't do more to protect him. And guilt eats at Bobby McRae, played by Michael Kenneth Williams, for not being able to give his son better advice and for encouraging Antron to cooperate with the police. By the time Antron is free, his father is hobbled by illness. Two sets of actors play the four teenagers who were barely in the throes of puberty when they were arrested, and adults when they were freed. Jarrell Jerome plays Wise from 16 through his adult years, A smart nod to the fact that he was the lone boy sentenced as an adult. Late in the series, Jerome is transcendent, depicting a trembling, terrified Wise as he's moved from one torture chamber at Rikers to another at Attica. For 13 years, more than double the time served by the other boys, Wise cycled between abuse at the hands of guards and other prisoners and madness in the relative safety of solitary confinement. While in prison, Wise's sister Marcy, who was trans, is murdered. Here, the prison chaplain, played by Jeff Williams, informs Wise of his sister's death. Jerome, as Corey Wise, responds.
She called my mom. Make sure she's okay.
We're here to make sure that you're okay, Corey.
Me?
Yes. We are here for you.
You're here for me. I'll be here forever, sir. I'm not sure what you mean.
There is anything.
I'll be here forever, sir.
All right.
I don't know what you mean.
All right, come on. Let's go, kid. Come on.
Don't touch me. Don't touch me.
The five teens who were arrested in 1989 were men when they were cleared in 2002 after a serial rapist confessed to the crime. News organizations published corrections and covered the story then, too. Still, nothing could really undo the years of damage to their reputations. Until now. DuVernay leaves viewers unable to forget the horrors five boys faced because adults responsible for upholding justice instead chose to subvert it. She illustrates how they became cogs in a bigger machine. But most of all, When They See Us issues a challenge. Now that we know exactly what the machine does, what will we do to stop it?
Soraya Nadia McDonald is the culture critic for The Undefeated. When They See Us is streaming on Netflix. On tomorrow's show, inside Kim Jong-un's North Korea, we'll speak with Washington Post Beijing bureau chief Anna Fifield, who's traveled to the country 12 times and interviewed members of the leader's family. We'll talk about daily life and economic changes in North Korea, the regime's brutal repression and surveillance, the failed nuclear talks with the U.S., and some strange moments when Dennis Rodman visited the country. Fifield's new book is The Great Successor. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies. Thank you.